Do you need that? Okay. First, it's my pleasure to be able to open tonight. I might add a quick note because some of you know Kumar Mehta, and he had accepted to do the opening tonight, but as it turns out, he has a medical emergency today, so he won't be here. Secondly, then, I'd like to say this is the third of a six-part series of talks that AHIMSA and the Institute for World Religions have put together for this kind of winter spring. And we're very delighted that tonight it's Swami Vedananda from the Ramakrishna Order in San Francisco. And his discussant will be Nipun Mehta, who is the founder of Charity Focus. And to make a brief introduction, I would probably just like to say that for neither of them do words count. So introductions can be not what you see, but what you watch. Swami Vedananda does admit to a background in physics and has been a monk now. He's a senior monk. And when I asked him basically a physics question one time, he said that was an entirely former life. When I asked him if he teaches, he said we have a different use for that word. And he is really a flower in the field. And it's his spirit which really infuses his talk. And therefore, we're very delighted that he's been able to be here tonight. And Nipun is somebody who worked with Sun Microsystems and then started going out and asking people what really makes you feel better, working in Sun Microsystems, working as for the immediate goals, or working in service. And so one of the first things that he and his friends did were to offer to help make websites for free of charge for nonprofits, and that's how our own website got started. So since that time, it's Charity Focus has blossomed to something like 2,000 or so people. And the whole point is that it is all simply done in the spirit of giving. He just recently, with his wife, took a walking tour of India. And so between service and walking and stories, both gentlemen are marvelous to enjoy an evening with, to walk away with a sense of spirituality. And at this point, I turn it to Swami Vedananda.
Is this on? Yes, I guess it is. Thank you. This is high tech. I'm not. This is more high tech than I am. Now, what do I do with it? Can this be anywhere, or does it have to be close to me? Anywhere. Oh, okay. Namo namo Buddha Divakaraya, namo namo Gautama Chandrikaya, namo namo Ananta Gunadharaya, namo namo Shakyanandanaya. We bow down to the Blessed One, the Lord Buddha. This is his holy hall. Om Asato Ma Sadgamaya Tamaso Ma Jyotirgamaya Mrityoramamritam gamaya Avira-virmaedhi Rudrayate dakshinang mukham Tenamam pahi nityam. Om, lead us from the unreal to the real. Lead us from darkness unto light. Lead us from death to immortality. Reach us through and through ourself, and evermore protect us from ignorance by thy sweet, compassionate face. Now, I've had quite a few discussions with Nick and with Kumar Mehta, and Kumar has discussed with Henry Baer, so there's been quite a turmoil here about what it is that I'm supposed to say. And there were a few changes, of course, in midstream, and but the title has remained constant, Yoga and the Awareness of Divinity. But I'll add to that, Yoga and the Awareness of Divinity put into the context of today's needs. The first thing I'll do is I'll kind of have my own... This thing is rather difficult. If I turn my head away, you don't hear anything, right? You're still here? Oh, okay. Anyway, I'm sorry, I'm not used to these things. Usually there's a nice thing here you can aim for. This you can't even see. Anyhow, this will be my interpretation of what I think the context of the needs of today is. I don't claim anything more than that. But in order to make Vedanta seem practical and interesting and worthwhile, you have to see how it fits into the present day. So I would like to kind of phrase it this way. That, first of all, what do we find? I mean, I'm talking about the negative sides. If you want to talk about the positive sides, there's a lot to be said about the positive sides. Things are great in so many ways, but also things are not so great in so many ways. And I'll talk about the not so great things, and with the idea that we can overcome those, and therefore all the great things can be... become possible goals. I think most of us find ourselves with a growing uneasiness. Things should be pretty good. I mean, you expect certain small troubles everywhere. That can be expected of life. But that big things are not getting any better. That, I think, is making people very uneasy. Not only big things in society, but big things on an individual level are not in a very good shape in many respects. There is a lot of turmoil, of course, in society between cultures, but there's also turmoil within individuals. Now, in the 1960s, there was a movement which people began looking in depth at themselves and at at the past, at the future, and they began turning toward deeper philosophies of life, and things seemed to be, there was a sense of hope in the air. Of course, I don't know, maybe you weren't present in the 60s, I was. And there was that sense, there was a sense of liveliness, you know, something was happening and we were heading somewhere. Finally, we were heading somewhere, that was kind of the idea. But this seems to have kind of run out in many respects, and we feel uneasy. I mean, not only international things are always going to be a source of trouble, and they always have been throughout human history. But why is there so much turmoil in families? Why do families break up? I mean, you know, someone says he's getting married, that's wonderful, and then pretty soon you know, he's been through three marriages already and he's trying his fourth. I mean, that sort of thing, and if you look at the statistics, the percentage of broken homes is huge. And what happens to the children from these homes? They have tremendous psychological problems. One man who's a professor at a university in the west side of the Bay, he said, he's a wonderful man, highly successful now, but at the age of 5, his family broke up, and that propelled him into an awful turmoil for many years. And then within individuals, there's a tremendous, somehow disappointment. We didn't make it. We thought we were going to make it. We thought we were going to get to something deep, and it hasn't happened. Now Hinduism is what Vedanta is. Vedanta equals Hinduism. Vedanta means the end of the Vedas. The Vedas are the scriptures of Hinduism. And all Hindus are Vedantists, if they're orthodox. We prefer to use the word Vedanta instead of Hinduism, because Hinduism has a lot of cultural implications which are there, and they're delightful and wonderful, but they're secondary. The primary thing is the essence of Hinduism, which comes from the Upanishads, which is the end of the Vedas, which is the Vedanta. So what contribution can Vedanta make to this situation? So I would like to divide our troubles into a series of crises. Everything's a crisis nowadays, I'll have my own crises. First of all, there's a crisis of identity. We don't know who we are. We don't know what we are. We come into this world, we find ourselves here, and we weren't asked to come here, we think. Somehow I open up my eyes and I see this wonderful, smiling, very caring, loving face. And that always takes care of me, and that's Mama. And then there's Daddy. And this and that, and so I slowly make my way in the world, and I slowly become aware of things. But where did I come from? What's the background of all this? And furthermore, every one of us knows that in the course of time, we shall majestically march off this stage. And so where are we going? What are we going to do? What's going to happen to us? Naturally, every religion has something to say about that. But most of it is, you know, you say, okay, well, that may be true, it may not be true. I haven't experienced it consciously anyway, so I don't know. I can take it as a hypothesis. This is what will happen. But I don't know, and if I don't know, I feel uneasy. What can I do something about it? Or am I just a helpless pawn on this stage? I didn't ask to come here, and I'm not going to ask to go either. But I'll be given the privilege anyway. So, crisis of identity. We don't know where we are heading, but worse than that, we don't know where we should be heading. I mean, it's all right, I'm heading this way, I started this way, I developed and went to school and did this and that, and I'm, you know, I have a path of a life's path, that's wonderful, that's okay. But is that the way it should be? Where should I be? What should I be doing? These are questions that really you can't get any very definite answers to. You have to find that out yourself somehow. And even when you find it out yourself, the tendency is sometimes to think, yes, I've found it. And then later on, maybe you find need some adjustment. Okay, crisis of identity, who we are. Then the crisis of goals. What should we be doing? I would like to help mankind. I would like to help people who are suffering. I feel greatly for those who are less fortunate. I feel great sympathy. But I am not like Nipun Mehta, who takes off for India and simply, you know, leaves everything behind. He goes off and does what he really wants to do. Most of us are tied down hand and foot, and we can't move like that. So, crisis of goals. What should we be doing? Next thing is crisis of belief. The nature of the present, the nature of the past, the nature of the hereafter. What is all this? There is some being called God, which I am told a lot of things about, but I have never experienced him or her or it. I don't even know anything about it. I can repeat what various religions tell me about it, but I don't really know anything. I have no experience of it. So what? This is a crisis of belief. What should I believe in? I mean, it's obvious if somebody is hurt, you want to help them. That's our heart goes out to that person. That's quite natural. That's simple. But as far as ultimate things are more distant, not just the immediate situation, which is usually more or less obvious, but as in terms of the goal of my life, in terms of what this thing is all about. Is there such a thing as God? And is it important that I should believe in God? Some religions do not believe in God. There are religions, but they say it's not necessary. Sankhya is one of the schools of Hinduism, and that they don't find it necessary to bring in a God. So all these things are there. I call that the crisis of belief. Then a crisis of values. Most of us are very, you know, stable and more or less satisfied, happy individuals. Yes, that's fine. But a huge fraction of society is not. They're not stable, they're not happy, they're totally confused, they're totally restless, they cause trouble for themselves and everybody else. Things run riot. I mean, what we used to call the normal standards of morality, I mean, these such people frequently just simply have no connection with whatsoever. So what is this? But it causes them to suffer. They're not happy with it. But yet they think this is the way to act. There's a tremendous, there's within individuals a turmoil of unresolved drives and emotions. So I call that the crisis of values. And then there's the confusion. It's not a crisis, it's just a plain old confusion of methods. What is the way out? Everybody tells us that my way is the way, or maybe that person's way is the way, but what is the way out? And is there any the way out? Okay, so these are my private crises, which I've expounded to you at excessive length. Now we will go to what Vedanta says about all this. I'll just speak now about what Vedanta is, that is to say what Hinduism is. And then I'm not going to systematically go through its approach to these crises at this point. Toward the end, before we end, I do want to do that, but not right now. Now I'll just present to you what Hinduism is. Now, Vedanta makes only one basic assumption, and everyone has to make a basic assumption. I mean, even if you don't believe in anything, you're making a basic assumption whether you like it or not. You're assuming that what you experience through the senses is really there. You don't question that. You may question it to a certain extent, but you cannot question it totally, because otherwise you're cutting off the ground from under your own feet. So everyone has to make some assumptions, and it's very scientific. You make certain assumptions, and you use those to draw certain conclusions. You then derive certain methods of investigating the problems you're investigating, and then if you find you don't come up with anything that makes any sense, you go back and question your assumptions. But until then, these are hypotheses, you simply accept them. If you get to satisfactory results, that does not prove that the assumption was correct, but at least it proves that it was helpful in analyzing the situation. The actual correctness of the initial assumption comes only in personal experience, which no one else can have for you. This is a complicated situation, but the only way to approach it, to make any sense of it at all, is what science does, namely, it lists certain assumptions, and then it goes ahead and draws its conclusions. Now, Vedanta makes only one basic assumption. Everything else is a derivative of that, or an elaboration of that, amplification of that. And that basic assumption is that the consciousness which underlies our existence, and we're all conscious, we're certainly conscious that we are conscious, the consciousness which underlies our existence is only reflected in the mind. But actually it is, at basis, an unchanging, unlimited substratum of our personality. Big words, lots of them. That's the assumption we make, that this consciousness which we have, which we're all conscious beings, and when we get hit over the head and we become unconscious, or when we go to sleep at night, we don't dream, let's say, we become unconscious. Nevertheless, you could say, well, where did consciousness go in that case? We will make this assumption that this consciousness within which I experience everything, even deep sleep is an experience, because when you wake up, you remember, I slept so well. You know, it was void, it was blank. But something remained because you were able to remember something. So there was a continuity there, something was going on. And when you dream, of course you're conscious. When you're dreaming, you're conscious of a world that you yourself have made up, but you're witnessing, you're conscious of it. Now, that consciousness, if you abstract the things that are in it, that consciousness itself, we say, is an unchanging background against which everything happens. Now you say that's unjustified, this and that, whatever. And never mind, it's an assumption. And it's like all assumptions. The question is the assumption reasonable or not? And the first thing about deciding whether the assumption is reasonable or not is to think about it. Don't just react, say, no, that can't be. You think about it and you imagine, what am I conscious of? I'm conscious of this, I'm conscious of that. I'm conscious of I. Everything, there's always, consciousness is the basis of everything for us. But we unjustifiably say it's part of the mind. There's no proof that it's not something else. Many people assume it's part of the mind. When the mind goes, you're no longer conscious. We're saying no. Consciousness itself is a substratum within which all my experience takes place. And it's a background. It's not subject to any change. It's the screen on which the movie of our life occurs. And that screen is never changed by the movie. So in the same sense that this consciousness is never changed by anything that happens in our experience. And you think about it for a while and see if that's a reasonable assumption. Anyway, that is what we make. Now, this has certain consequences. It's just not my consciousness, it is consciousness itself. And in fact, my personality, my being, appears in that consciousness. So all beings appear in consciousness. In other words, all beings share this consciousness fully. So all beings are of equal worth. There isn't one that is better than another, one that's more privileged than another. I mean, the body and the mind are different. Some will be quite brilliant and some will be less brilliant and so forth. But in terms of qualities of mind, yes, there are differences. There must be differences. A manifestation here depends on differences. If everything were the same, I couldn't see anything. The reason I can see anything at all is because there are these differences. But the differences do not represent any difference in value. The value of each being is the same. And the value of each being is given by the value of that underlying consciousness, which is the essence on which everything occurs. So every being is equally holy. That's one conclusion. Not only every being, that includes human beings and animals, it also includes things. Everything that's perceived in consciousness is perceived on that unitary background and is of the same in terms of its existence, in terms of it, of the its value, it is of the same worth. I mean, you use a broom to sweep the floor and then you throw the broom in the corner. Now, why do we do that? Because that broom has been useful to us. There's a certain respect we show even to brooms, even to tools. In India, they worship their tools. There's a special time during the Dasara, the 10 days of the in the fall, where they worship their tools. Because you show respect to everything. Everything appears in that consciousness. Everything is holy. So. Now, this consciousness, because everything that exists is seen or perceived within consciousness, everything that exists is perceived in consciousness. So you cannot separate consciousness from existence. So that existence, so this thing, this substratum, the screen on which our life occurs is characterized by consciousness, is characterized by existence. It exists. We consider those things very significant. Now, because it is the unchanging background of everything that is perceived, this consciousness is the real perceiver, the real I, the real essence of me. The ego, my surface I, is something that happens much later. I am big, I am small, I was born in this country, I was born in that country, I'm of this color, and I'm of this hair is that color, and you know, all these, and I am intelligent, I am not so intelligent, I'm dull, I can't manage. All these things that we associate with me comes much later. And all of that is seen in consciousness. So consciousness is the real perceiver. there is something, this ego is something that is secondary, that comes later. So this is the unchanging, because it's the background of everything, it is unchanging. And our feelings, our relative feelings of well-being, of peace, and of joy are also felt within that, are also seen within that. So what does that make it? That this consciousness, this substratum of everything, is not only consciousness, its existence, and it's also joy. So we say Sat Chit Ananda, existence, consciousness, and bliss. This is the reality within which everything takes place. This is the reality in which all my life takes place, in which I see you. This is the essence of you, it's the essence of me. In other words, there is beyond this physical and mental plane. These things occur on a substratum. And that substratum is infinite and eternal. We say it is infinite and eternal, and we derive it from this one idea that of the existence of that basic consciousness in which everything is perceived. Now, existence, consciousness, bliss, it is eternal, it is unchanging. This is the divine. This is what you mean by divinity. What is God? God, you can say many things, different religions say many things, different things, but God is first of all assumed to be all-loving, all-full, all-encompassing, undecaying, unchanging, and fully conscious. He's a conscious being to whom we can relate. So what is the idea of God? This is the idea of, it's an infinite reality that is the very essence of everything that we see. And the conclusion of that is that really whatever we perceive is divine. You can say, well, you're skipping a few steps here. We want a few more steps of proof. Well, I'll hide behind the clock. I don't have that much time. But the basic, then what is the basic statement? This universe, in all its colorful variety, is actually seen on that background, is actually varied readings of this background reality, which is unchanging, unlimited, and therefore eternal, which in effect supports everything and is the reality of everything, which is also bliss or love, which is akin to what Meister Eckhart called the Godhead, which is divinity, the divine reality. This is the divine reality Vedanta talks of. Infinity, eternity, and what is the proof of all this? If it were simply the theory, this is a nice theory. We've built up a beautiful paradigm here, and everything is perfect, so I can just quickly run out of the room before you ask any questions, and everything will be just fine, right? No, we make an additional statement here that this can be experienced and has been experienced. And our scriptures, what we call the Upanishads, the ends of the Vedas, which is the meaning of Vedanta, our scriptures record the experiences of these people who have experienced that reality. If it could not be experienced, it would be of no use to anybody, and we could pass college examinations on it and get PhDs and obtain nice university jobs, but it wouldn't do anybody any good. but it can be experienced. And what is the method of experiencing it? The method is called yoga. And yoga is, what you normally talk about, yoga studio. That is 1/100 of 1% of what is meant by yoga. It is yoga. It's genuine yoga. It's called Hatha yoga, and it's used in Raja yoga as a tool to quieten the mind, to strengthen the body. It is useful. I'm not saying anything negative about it. But I'm saying there's very much more than that. That is just one, the tiniest portion. But I should make the first statement, though. I should again state what the result of all my analysis is. The statement of it that Vedanta makes is that you can never. It is impossible to experience anything except infinity, except divinity. You can call it God, you can call it the Godhead, you can call it whatever you like. An infinite, pure and perfect, all-loving reality that contains all the things that you want, all the things you normally ascribe to the Godhead are there in fullest measure, in infinite measure. There is nothing else is ever perceived by anyone at any time, nor can ever be perceived. When we see individuals, we are reading, we're seeing God, but we are reading it in this way as a person, tall, short. It's like a man. He will be the father of a certain person. He will be the son of another person. He will be the boss of a person. He will be the servant of a person. He will be the playmate of someone. He'll be the teammate of someone. In each of these situations, he wears a different dress and behaves in a different way. As a father, he will behave differently toward his son than he does to his own father. He behaves differently. People look on him differently, but it's the same individual that's appearing in every case. In that sense, it is God that's appearing before us in all respects, in all beings, in all things, assuming this form, assuming that form. If he comes as a horse, I give him oats. If he comes as a thief, I call 911, help. But it is God alone that I'm experiencing. I'll have to do all this. If someone comes at me and, you know, as a thief in the night, I will certainly call the police. And then they'll put him in jail and this and that. Well, that's all right. God, in that form, did these things. And in order to keep him from doing the same thing to others, he has to be, you know, okay. But the point is, I do all the necessary things, but I should never forget the essence of that being is divine. However I may have to treat that person, the essence is divine. That's a very bold thing to say, because even wicked people normally call wicked, they are wicked because something has, they're not seeing things properly. If they were seeing things properly, if they were true to their own inner nature, they would not be wicked. But as being wicked, we have to deal with them in order to protect, like this society, and okay. But it would be wrong if we forgot that basically it's divinity we're looking at. All right. Now, what are the different yogas? There are basically four yogas. And the first one I will talk about is Raja Yoga, the kingly yoga. I don't know why it's kingly. Anyway, traditionally it's called that. It's also called Dhyana Yoga, the yoga of meditation. And the basic assumption is that Remember, these are all methods to realize the truth of what I'm talking about. You're not left just to have to believe any. You don't have to believe anything. You have to try to experience the deepest part of your own being. You have to be as true to yourself as you can be. That's your obligation. But you don't have to believe anything. Just try to experience it, go to the depth, and then what you experience, that you believe. You can take things as assumptions. Yes, these are assumptions. They will lead me, you know, it is said they will lead me to the goal. I will try that, and if it leads me to the goal, that's fine. If not, I'll have to change the assumption. Okay, what's the basic assumption of Raja Yoga? The idea of that there is even this substratum of consciousness is not necessary for some of these yogas. Raja Yoga, it's not necessary. You don't have to believe anything. You don't have to even accept the assumption of that consciousness, that existence, knowledge, bliss. The only thing you have to assume is that, and you can verify this by personal experience, as the mind becomes quieted, peace flows within, joy flows within, understanding flows within, clarity flows within yourself. In other words, as you quieten the mind, great things happen. So the aim of Raja Yoga is to quieten the mind. Yoga chitta vritti nirodha. The vrittis, that is the waves of the mind, the waves of the chitta, of the mind, being controlled, being fully controlled, that is called yoga. That's the second aphorism of the Yoga Sutras, the sutras of Patanjali, which form the basis of all that we call meditation, or even this Hatha Yoga. If the mind is compared to a lake, you can understand it quite clearly. If the lake is full of waves, you don't see to the depth, you just see the surface. And that's our problem. We look at life, we look at only the surface of life. If we were to look at the depths, at life in depth, things would be quite different for us. But we judge books by their covers. We judge that we don't penetrate to the depth of anything. And so it's like this lake, agitated surface of the lake, which you cannot see the depth of. But as the lake quietens, and this happens, I've seen it at Lake Tahoe, when the water becomes very quiet, you actually are not aware that there's any water there at all. You see the bottom with tremendous clarity. Every pebble on the bottom, even quite far down, can be seen clearly. So if you can quieten the mind, that's all you have to do. You don't have to believe anything. You don't have to assume anything about God or consciousness or anything. All these highfalutin things you can forget about. Just think of the mind as a lake and try to quieten this mind. That's the object of meditation. And as you quieten the mind, you begin to perceive within it certain things. And as you, when you, now this is the claim by those who have succeeded fully. They say that as the mind becomes absolutely quiet, that which is the background of the mind is seen. Something is seen which you don't see now. And what is seen is that existence, consciousness, bliss, is that infinite background, is that divinity. That is what is seen when the mind becomes utterly quiet. That is what the people who have experienced it say. But you don't have to believe that. Just quieten your mind and see what happens. So now, in the process of quietening the mind, first of all, you have to. There are eight steps, eight limbs. One is, they call yama, niyama, and so forth. There are certain moral disciplines that you have to go through. Morality, you can never get around. You say, oh, it's old-fashioned. No, it's not old-fashioned. Your mind will never quieten down if you don't live a moral existence. It's absolutely essential. It's the background, the basis of everything. Then there are questions of posture, how to sit, because there are certain things in the body that we don't know of. There's a force in the body, actually, that as this force, it's called the Kundalini, and it's well described in books on yoga, but it's something mostly we don't know about. But as that force becomes activated and rises in the body, certain experiences occur. You can see physical things have a difference on the way you think. Just if you're used to drinking coffee, just stop drinking coffee for a few days and see what happens. So the physical things have a great relationship to the mind anyway. Anyway, this is a whole huge different subject, but these things, the posture is very important because there are certain physical things that do happen. Then breathing, the methods of breathing. By breathing, you can get hold of the energy, the inner energy of our being, certain ways of breathing. But it's also very dangerous because you can bring up these energies and you might not be able to control them. There's a whole science to this. Anyway, and then meditation, and then withdrawal from the outside world and concentration within, and then different stages of concentration, and that's meditation. Okay, that's one method of approaching the problem of life. Another method is karma yoga. The assumption of karma yoga is that selfishness is the cause of all trouble because it shrinks our view and our sympathies. Unselfishness is the way to expand. Expansion is life, contraction is death. You do good because it is our nature to love the good, not because of rewards or punishment. In this way, we become fully devoted to what is good. And when we become devoted to what is good, we become pure in heart. Purity in heart means we don't have two minds. We don't believe one thing and do another thing. In that purity of mind, a purity innocence. Purity means the innocence of a little child. Christ talked about, let these suffered children to come unto me, for of such is the kingdom of heaven. And he also said, blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Now, it's a very extraordinary statement. He said, blessed are the righteous, blessed are the peacemakers, blessed, yes, and all these things are easy to understand. All the other beatitudes are easy to understand. This one is not. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. He didn't say indirectly experience or, you know, through the mediation of this and that, or if you believe this and that, you will. No. Purity of heart is the only thing he required. So, and this purity is what is one of the things that we're aiming for, and that is this yoga of action, this karma, this dedicated work with unselfish motives, work in a spirit of love and a spirit of dedication, brings about this innocence, this purity, this childlike quality, brings about this purity of heart, within which, in that pure heart, there's a great softness and a great sweetness. And that sweetness you begin to feel that it's not the sweetness of something external or caused by something. It's an uncaused sweetness that seems to pervade things as you get deeper into it. And that itself is the sweetness of God, or the sweetness of that divine reality. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Then there is Jnana Yoga, the yoga of knowledge, in which There, the approach there is, well, if none of this is God, if I don't see God anywhere, why should I pay any attention to this? Neti, neti, not this, not this. What is that divine reality that I'm after? Well, I know it's not this, and it's not that, and it's not this, and it's not that. Whatever you come across, you analyze it. Is this the reality? No, it's still superficial. If you can truly, once you say it's not this, if you can truly renounce it and take your mind off it, then it works. But generally we say, no, 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 chocolate is not good for me, chocolate is not good for me. And we reach for the chocolate anyway. You know, yeah, a little bit won't matter. Surely, no, I mean a few, after all, a few calories, what difference does it make? No, you take your mind off it, you're not even interested in it. It isn't that you say, oh, I'll be very austere, I won't take that. No, you're not even, the mind doesn't even go there. If you say, this is not truth, I'm after truth, I'm after that fundamental reality, where is it? This is not it. Your mind simply doesn't even go there. Eventually, when you negate everything that is not truth, something something remains. That's the claim of the Jnana Yoga. Something remains which is the truth. Again, you don't start out with an assumption that you are going. You don't have to have any of these fancy assumptions. You simply start on the process and see where it leads you. Jnana Yoga. Then comes Bhakti Yoga. Now, Bhakti Yoga is specifically related to God. And Bhakti Yoga, probably most people will follow that as a primary yoga. Now, none of these yogas are generally followed alone. Everyone follows a combination. But Bhakti Yoga is the worship, actually the worship of God. But what it means is it's not, I mean, you talk about, yes, a God that gives you this and that's concerned about you, and those things, those ideas are very, very much prevalent. But the basic idea there is that when you're worshiping God, you are surrendering all that is finite and dumping it into this infinite container, which is the Lord. That's the idea. Whatever is finite, I offer to the fire of the infinite, I consume in the fire of the on the altar. So, and then that personality, we talk a lot about the personality of God. God, the incarnations of God are there. God manifested. In other words, certain individuals appear on this earth that are so full of holiness, so full of divine power, that one doesn't know what to do with them. They're not, you can't say it's hereditary. I mean, did Christ's family was a, you know, his father was a carpenter. Did he get all of his power and his inspiration from a carpenter? You know, I mean, Joseph was a holy person, but I mean, Christ was such a brilliant light, I mean, of such extraordinary magnitude. Can you say it came from his parents? No, we say that we make a different category for such beings. We say they're incarnations of God in the sense that they are so full of the consciousness of infinity, of divinity, so full of power. They bring power to this earth. They bring power for good. Some of the power is going to be used for evil also. In this world, nothing is pure. But I mean, the power that Christ brought to earth after 2,000 years is still as fresh as it was, and more powerful than it was even when it was brought to earth. That's Christ. Buddha is the same. 2,500 years ago, what the world, I mean, if the world did not have the ideas of Buddha, it would be, I mean, the confusion would be enormous. I mean, these beings who come like this are of such a stature that one can't say they're just simply human beings. So naturally we worship them. And through worshiping them, we acquire their characteristics, we become closer to them, we, in a way, become surrounded by their influence, by their aura, and that lifts us up to that realm where they are. That's the idea of bhakti yoga. Now, these are the four yogas. Now, I will close by going over the crises that I identified in the beginning and see what it is that we have done. What has Vedanta said about all these things? First one is the crisis of identity. Who am I? The conclusion of all these things that I've said is, I am, for one thing, I am not this body. This body has come and this body will go, but something will persist. There's the mind, for instance. The mind need not die when the body dies. There's no proof that the mind dies. Or you say the mind is connected with the brain. When the brain dies, the mind has to die. But we say no. The subtle body goes. The mind goes along with the, the mind is transmigrates. We have the idea of reincarnation. It's not an absolutely central concept, but it's very helpful. It's conservation of energy. All the energy you put into your own life, where does it go? Suddenly your life is cut off. Where does all that energy go? We say that the energy stays in, it's your mind that had all this energy, this drive that you manifested. Suddenly you're cut off by death. That mind has not been, its desires have not been satisfied. It will assume another body to satisfy those unfulfilled desires. But again, when you know who you really are, that process stops. I am not the mind either. I am pure spirit. I am that infinite consciousness. That's my real nature. That, who am I? I am that. I am not the body, I am not the mind. I am pure spirit. What is what you could describe these characteristics? Existence, it exists. It is consciousness itself. It is bliss itself. It's the background, the reality of everything. That is my true nature. That is my real identity. The crisis of goals is just this. Where do we come from? Where are we heading? We come from this, we come from bliss. We live in that infinite bliss, although we're not aware of it. We see all sorts of confusion and we go back into that bliss at the end. This is our nature, this is our, the essence of us is consciousness and bliss, eternity. Actually, we need nothing. We're infinite by nature. We don't need all these things that we think we need and desperately must have. If you didn't have any of the things that you thought you had, you may suffer in body and suffer in mind. Yes, okay. Then you should do something about it naturally, and other people should help you. Yes. But really speaking, even if you had nothing, you would not need anything. You are that infinite reality. That is your essence, which nobody can get beyond. Crisis of beliefs, the nature of God. Every path leads to God alone. That is one of our primary statements. Sri Ramakrishna said, as many faiths, so many paths. Ye yatha mam prapadyante tam sthathayava bhajamyaham. As, this is Sri Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, in whatsoever way people worship me, in that way I reward them. Mama vartmanu vartante manushya parta sarvasaha. It is my path that all beings tread in whatever way they are going. No one is doing anything except walking on the path of God. No one is headed toward anything else except God, no matter what religion they follow, no matter what they say and how contradictory it is. It is Sri Krishna as saying that I is, that he is referring to is that infinite reality. It is the path of God that all beings tread, no matter what path they are treading. So everyone is heading toward that infinite goal. Crisis of values. Turmoil of unresolved drives and emotions within. All these things have to be controlled. If you want to realize the depth of your being, there cannot be this turmoil of drives and emotions. Somehow this has to be straightened out. Otherwise, that depth will not come. Now, confusion of methods. There are four. Shankaracharya talked about four. In other words, he resolved all methods of spiritual practice into four. Nitya, nitya, vastu, viveka. That means the discrimination between what is real and what is unreal. How do you reach this goal? Discrimination between what is real and what is unreal. What is real here and what is unreal? What is precious here, what is not precious? What is divine here, what is not divine? Second method is, when you find the goal, give up all the things that don't lead you to it. The third thing is the moral virtues, and the fourth thing is the desire for freedom, the desire for understanding, the desire for liberation. And Sri Ramakrishna made that the first one. First, you have to desire to be free. Then you can practice everything and it will be successful. All right. Now I've taken 15 minutes more than the allotted time. But as a conclusion, I think for a few minutes we should sit quietly, and there will be a little guided meditation for just a few minutes. So if you will sit quietly, sit straight. The spine should be as straight as you can. You can lean back against the chair if you like. Feet should be on the ground and comfortably placed. You can, of course, normally people sit in this cross-legged posture because that's a very steady posture, but that's not absolutely necessary at all. First, we will wish well to all beings in front of us, all the lands that are ahead of us. May they all be at peace. May they be happy. May they become illumined. May all beings to our right and all the lands in that direction be at peace. May they all be happy. May they be illumined. And in all lands to our left, may all beings be at peace. May all beings be happy. May all beings be illumined. And to the rear, in back of us, all the lands in back of us, may all be at peace. May all be happy. May all become illumined. And all the space above, all this wide universe above, may all beings be at peace, may all be happy, may all be illumined. And in the earth below, and all the spaces below, may all be at peace, may all be happy, may all be illumined. Then within my own body, I see light. I focus on light within. My body is full of light. I focus in the region of my heart, and I imagine that that region is full of light. It's an infinite light, cool and soothing. In that light, I can place whatever cherished object I wish. I can see the form of Christ. I can see the form of Buddha. Any form I wish, I can place in that light. I can imagine an infinite ocean of radiance. I only imagine that light. Infinite light, uncaused, eternal, all-pervading light. I am surrounded by that light, and I concentrate on that light within my heart. If I concentrate on a form, I concentrate on the form as full of light. I concentrate on that form as a loving presence. I find joy in my heart. I find that love within my heart. I find sweetness within my heart. I concentrate on that love, on that sweetness, on that form. I try to absorb that sweetness, that form within myself, that it may flood my whole being. I concentrate on that sweetness in my heart. Unto us and unto all beings.
Is that my cue, Nick? This is question and answer time. But before we do that, I wanted to give you an introduction of Swami Vedananda that I got when I first met him. First time I see him, I believe it was Kumar that introduced us. Mm. And he said, "This is the humblest man, humblest monk," he said, "that you will ever meet." And I said, "Wow." And then I got to know him over time, and an experience of humility that I have seen and the power of it left a very profound impact on me. So in Olima, they have these 1,000, 1,500 person gatherings, and people prepare, and there's food, and there are lots of helpers preparing the day before. There was one person in charge of having those servers fed, and that was Swami Vedananda. And while they were all working hard right before their meal, Swami Vedananda and I were, you know, talking and about all kinds of esoteric things. You know, I was pressing him, needling him, you know, "Ramakrishna, yeah, but, you know, is he alive? You know, what difference does it make? Can you really feel the presence? You know, is it just all theoretical?" And he was giving me profound answers. And we were having this esoteric discussion, in the middle of which he realized that we were really, really late. So we walk onto the kitchen. There's all these people. And a normal person would have just been scattered and, you know, "Oh my God, I got to do this. Swami Vedananda just goes in smoothly like an artist, goes into the kitchen, and he's still talking to me, responding to the queries as if nothing has changed. But he's working with his hands left and right. You know, all this pressure is on him. Probably Swami Prabhudananda would have come and said, "What's going on? You know, is the food ready or not?" But none of that really bothered him. He worked with this equanimity that was beyond compare. And I think that is a result of his humility. So the reason why I share this is because this is a Q&A session, and the opportunity that you have to spend an evening, as we have been, but perhaps to share dialogue with him is a unique one, and I hope you can take advantage of it and benefit from it in the ways that I certainly have. I'm going to do... Just to start it off, I'm going to do, instead of a multiple choice answer, I'm going to do a multiple choice question. One is a very practical one, one is a cultural one, and one is a mischievous one. I have to. My wife is looking at me over there saying, "Oh no."
What's coming now?
What's coming now? Practical question is, and I just want to lay this out and, you know, set the rest of the questions will be from all of you, set the tone here. What is Vedanta is known for its practical nature. So what does Vedanta look like for a practitioner on a day-to-day basis? Do you go to a temple? You describe the four yogas, but how does that practice in a daily life apply to a normal Vedanta practitioner? That's a practical question. Cultural question is, You talked about God and consciousness in a very, what I would say, an enlightened way in the culture of Hinduism, not so much Vedanta, but you equated Hinduism with Vedanta. It's filled with images of gods and deities. So what role does that play in Vedanta, in the practice of Vedanta? Certainly it's part of the culture, very big part of the Hindu culture. What role does that play in Vedanta? And the mischievous...
What's your mischievous question?
Mischievous question. I know you were gunning for that. Swami Vedanta never... I think Nick and probably Henry know, he never likes to talk about himself. And you have to really, really press him hard to say even if you say that he was... I can't even look at him and say he was a PhD from physics, in physics from Cal, because he would not like that. But the question I have is, you know, at what crossroads did you decide, and what were the questions that compelled you to go on the path of in search, and what landed you to Vedanta? It's a personal question. You may or may not want to. If we had rehearsed this, certainly this would be axed out, but since we didn't. So those are the three questions. You're welcome to answer any of them, any one of them, and then think up other questions, because I'll move around with the mic and pass it on.
Well, answering the last question first, I don't know what happened to this. It's working. Answering the last question first, because I can dispose of it briefly. No, I was living at the university here and going to school, and I was living in a rooming house where there were three. It was an international rooming house. It was run by a Japanese lady who was an expert in the practice of flower arranging, and she taught it. So she was full of the culture of Japan, and she was running the house. It was her house. And then there was a Chinese young man who had graduated, I think, from the University of Hawaii. I think he was in graduate school at Cal. And then there was this African-American man who had graduated from San Francisco State University and was taking graduate courses at Cal also. And then me, you know, little old me. So the three of us became extremely good friends, and somehow he was looking. I wasn't particularly looking. I'd figured there was no answer, so I was just simply doing my, you know, my studies as well as I could. And but he was looking, and he came to me one day and he said, you know, I've just been to this temple in San Francisco and I've heard this Swami, and he's the greatest thing since, you know. I mean, he's just incredible, so you've got to come and hear him. Well, I mean, we'd spent, you know, I mean, like you do in school like that, if you're rooming like that, you spend half the night, you know, discussing this, that, and the other. And so we knew each other pretty well, and so I said, all right, well, fine. I mean, if you think it's that great. So I went, and I was impressed, but confused, and these were the strangest things that I ever heard in my life. If I had heard myself say these things at that time, I would have simply thought I was mad. You know, what is all this? What is all this? Anyway, from a Judeo-Christian background, but not practicing at all. And but then he did a strange thing. I came up, he moved to San Francisco, and I came out to visit him once, and I come into his, you know, apartment, and there was a room which was very dimly lit, and there was a low table there, and there were three pictures on that table, and there were flowers and incense. And I said, Richard, what in the world has happened to you? I mean, have you? I was totally shocked. Well, you see, this is Sri Ramakrishna, Holy Mother Swamiji. These are three holy people. I said, well, I mean, what is the meaning of this? What are you doing? What is this? This worship you're doing? It seemed very unpleasant to me. Anyway, then he did a more horrible thing than that, which, you know, totally threw me for a loop. He told me once, I'm going to join the monastery. I said, you're going to do what? Anyway, he did, and I thought he was hopelessly lost. You know, what's the, you know, he's gone beyond the pale for sure this time. Anyway, somehow the magic slowly worked on me, and before I knew it, I found, well, if these things are true at all, and the Swami in those days was very well known, he was extremely dynamic, Swami Ashokananda, extremely dynamic, extremely thoughtful, tremendous philosopher, and very charismatic, and so I succumbed. But then the idea came to me, if I'm going to take this seriously, I've got to take it all the way. So then I said, okay, The only thing to do is to join this monastery and give my whole life to it, because if I don't do that, I'll never be satisfied. And here I am. Now, the second question, as to in India, all the gods and goddesses of India, some of them are amazing. Sometimes it's a sort of a round stone with three triangles or something like that, and that's worshipped as the Divine Mother. Oh no, three eyes, I guess, two like this, one like that. And then Shiva, you've got this stone, and then there's a basin around it, you pour water over it, and that's Shiva, the Lord of the universe. You know, it all seems so strange, it seems so unbelievable, so disconnected from the high philosophy that of Vedanta, and you just wonder, what is the meaning of it all? And so Nipun's question is extremely relevant. The point is that there are certain basic elements to religion. One is the philosophy. The second is the mythology. And the third is the ritual. The philosophy is, you know, has been honed and polished to perfection. You know, it's what you present to the public. This is Vedanta. Then behind that, you know, when you open the curtain, you find all these strange images, and you find histories of gods and goddesses, and they did this and they did that, and they came down, and people believe those things literally if you go to India. And so you say, well, you know, maybe I'd better close this curtain again and just concentrate on the philosophy. No, because we need all three. The philosophy is fine and, you know, great. But the mythology is philosophy exemplified. How is it put into practice in life? That's what the mythology shows. It isn't that you have to believe in the literal accuracy of that. That you can, as you wish. But it shows how people have actually lived that philosophy. And the third is the ritual, which is a philosophy made even more concrete. I mean, it says offer everything to God, offer everything to that, you know, surrender everything. All these things are to be offerings to the divine. You actually do that. I mean, if you just mentally sit there, yes, I've offered everything to God, but I'm still enjoying it. My Cadillac, I'm going to keep nice and warm in the garage, and you know, I'm not going to get rid of that. You know, so, but here you actually give everything. You go to the altar and you surrender everything. There are people who give, you know, everything they have. And then, of course, we also have troubles. People are, say, incurably sick, and the doctors have given up all hope. And what am I going to do? My heart does not allow me to let that person simply die. I must do something. I yearn to do something. So I prayed. I prayed to God. May that person be cured. Now you say, well, now if you think of God as the infinite background of everything, how is that going to cure this person? No, there's an aspect to divinity which works in our lives also. And people have found that this is true. These things happen, these things work. You say, okay, well, you deluded yourself. If you really looked at it carefully, you wouldn't say it was the action of God, it was the action of natural forces. Maybe so. Try it yourself if you want, if you're interested. People have tried it, they have found they get help. They found that God is a living presence that you can approach. It's Sri Ramakrishna saw the Divine Mother as a companion in the room. You can say, well, that doesn't fit in with our philosophy. Okay, that's fine, but I mean, it was his experience. Well, he was deluded. Well, if he was deluded, his holiness was so tremendous, his love for people was so tremendous, his beneficial effect on everyone was so tremendous, then give me that delusion, let it come. I'll be happy to be deluded if that's the result of it. So these are, you know, that's why all these images are there. That's why people, you know, I mean, this is the life. This is religion brought to life is how this happens, mythology and ritual. First question was?
What does the daily practice look like?
Daily practice, what does daily practice look like? Usually, in every religious home in India, you could say, there's a shrine. It is the policy of our swamis that wherever we have a living group, there'll always be a shrine. Now, the shrine means it can be anything. It can be a corner of the room, it can be a separate room, but it's an area in which only spiritual thoughts are thought, in which only spiritually dedicated deeds are done. It may be a blank place where you're going to sit and think of the highest philosophy, that's fine. Anyway, only that gets done there. Or it may be an altar with pictures like my friend had, pictures of gods and goddesses or holy people, or maybe just simply flowers. It must be a beautiful place, a place that's pleasing to the mind. And so that when you go there, you feel good. You feel sort of cleansed. You feel holy. It's an area which is kept for that. So every home, every real Hindu home has such a place, or at least a corner where they, you know, devoted to that. In the morning, there's always a period of meditation. You always get up early. Getting up late on Sunday morning, I'm going to sleep in, is absolutely no good. It's something, you know, that's great in college, and you've stayed up till 3 o'clock every morning, so this morning you're going to sleep in. That's fine. That's all right. Do that. But it's not what a spiritual aspirant wants to do. He wants to get up before dawn. The holiest hour is the hour just before dawn, when the spiritual ideas become easy to think. The world is very quiet. The turmoil of the world is highly quietened. And so it becomes easier to think of spiritual things. So a spiritual person would never want to, would just not feel right sleeping in and all that. It doesn't make any sense. You feel like getting up when it's still dark, and then you may take some a wash or something like that. Anyway, you sit for meditation. And that meditation is usually there. It's a teacher. We recommend that there be a teacher to guide you along the path, someone who has gone some distance ahead. So then there'll be meditation. Then in the evening, again, maybe at noon, there may be meditation or may not be. In the evening, there'll again be meditation. And then during the day, whatever you do, you can never be too far from those ideals. Whatever I do, first of all, I have to be very moral. I have to be conscious. I cannot approach God and cheat my customers if I'm a businessman at the same time. That doesn't work. I mean, you'll find this so contradictory, you won't be able to do it. So your daily life has to be centered on these ideas. You have to begin to feel the presence of God every moment of your life. If not every moment, whenever you think of it, you want to think of that divine reality. This world is not just what I see, but there's a depth within it. There is a dimension within it that I don't see and that I should see. That dimension is what will give me depth and will give me understanding, will give me what I want. So every moment I should try to remember that. The whole day should be filled with that. Of course, it isn't because you have so many things, you have to pay attention to so many things. But whenever you can, you bring the mind back to that. And so for that, the Hindu will choose something called the chosen ideal. The chosen ideal, Ishta Devata, is the form of that divine reality that appeals to him that he wants to concentrate on. It may be an incarnation of God or a very holy person. It may be Buddha or Christ, or we have Sri Ramakrishna. It could be the Divine Mother. It could be in her many forms. It could be Shiva. These are all these Hindu gods and goddesses are all principles. They all embody a certain approach to the divine. And so you'll want to concentrate on one or the other. You choose one that will be your chosen ideal. You stick with that for the rest of your life. This is what you want to. This is your boat to carry you to that realization, using that being, that form. You meditate on that. If you pray to that, you repeat the name. One very powerful method of remembering divinity is to repeat the name of God. There are many names. God has many names. In Christianity, there's a famous prayer from the Eastern Orthodox tradition, Lord Jesus Christ, Son of the living God, have mercy on me. And it has different other forms. Sometimes it's just Lord Jesus Christ, have mercy on me. Anyway, sometimes they add the words a sinner. Of course, we don't believe anybody's a sinner. Everyone is pure divinity. This any errors on the surface are just surface phenomena. Deep down, we are divine. We are not sinners. But anyway, in Christianity, you have this prayer. Lord Jesus Christ, Son of the living God, have mercy on me. Anyway, just remembering that brings the figure of Christ to mind, brings his love to mind. Who could have greater love for humanity than to willingly undergo the sacrifice he underwent? I mean, just thinking of that just moves your heart. Imagine that. For the welfare of beings, he underwent that horrendous sacrifice, and he knew what he was doing. He knew what was going to happen to him. He underwent it anyway. Like that, you have a chosen ideal and you meditate on him or her. And repeating the name, repeating his name or her name, or repeating some holy name, Om Tat Sat, or Hari Om, or, you know, so many mantras there are. Usually you get the mantra from a teacher. And the teacher will ask you, what is your chosen ideal? What form of this divinity or of infinity do you wish to concentrate on? Then there are appropriate names that have been discovered that help you to quieten the mind so that you can attain the reality of that form. Anyway, all these practices you do, this takes up your whole day. There's no time left over for anything else. End of question.
Stuff. You can raise your hands if you have questions.
Swami, I like your analogy of the screen, which is the consciousness behind everything, and the movie that's being played. But it seems like there's a whole slew of movies being played. There's a variety of beliefs and practices. Any place you go in the world, there's about 100, if not 1,000 different religions. And unfortunately, there's very little respect that people have for one another's belief. Most people have a basic belief in one particular religion, and they believe that others are in error or dangerously incomplete. So intolerance seems to be sort of intrinsic in virtually every creed. So my question to you is, religion has created wars of conquest, the caste system, stoning of heretics, sodomy laws, taboos, all kinds of other actions which lead to bias and prejudice and inhumanity, which is the exact opposite of what you are trying to accomplish by getting into the screen rather than a movie. I can see how an individual, a few limited individuals, are able to get to that particular place. But how can you make that practical so that the world becomes a more humane and harmonious place?
Yes, that's the real problem, and that's the most difficult thing to say. I mean, it would be presumptuous for me to, you know, say this is the way to do it, but what occurs to me anyway is that somehow, see, if you listen to the various religions and what they say about each other, as I do sometimes when I go to interfaith meetings, sometimes I ask myself, how in the world is it ever possible for these people to be on the same platform together? They're saying things which are utterly contradictory to each other. And then they're going to do horrible things to each other because they don't believe, you know, because others don't believe the way they believe. This has been the history of religion. Nothing has caused more bloodshed. Not one single force has caused more bloodshed than religion. That's all true. And it would be presumptuous for me to say that I have an answer to that question. But I can, you know, like anybody else, I can express an opinion. And I would say that the first thing to be realized is that those people who maintain these highly sectarian views that my way is the only way. I once had a person draw on a piece of paper, there were two areas, two squares, and then there was one narrow set of parallel lines between them. And this is this life, and this is heaven, and there's only one bridge, and that bridge is what his religion was. And it was a subset of Christianity. It was a Protestant faith. I won't say what faith it was, but it was a Protestant faith, only one out of all the Protestant faiths. And so I said, well, what about the others? Well, sorry, you know. And then I had another person say to me, again, I won't tell you what faith he was. He was not a Christian. Well, I don't know, maybe that they are considered Christians, I don't know. But anyway, they're not one of the Orthodox sects anyway. He said to me, well, we have the truth, we know it, and you people are working for the devil. We were in our retreat in Olima. We wanted a new pump for a well that we had dug, and we said we hired this person to, you know, get a pump. He said, well, let me come and talk to you. I said, why? He always from San Rafael, he's going to come 20 miles to Olima to talk? Why can't he say it on the phone? No, I want to come to talk. All right, so he came. And he said, well, you know, you've always been very nice to us, and I appreciate that, and I thought I should come and tell you in person. I didn't want to be, to offend you, but, you know, we have the truth, and we know it, and you people are working for the devil, so I can't do anything for you. But if you come to my office, I'll be glad to sell you a pump. Anyway, that's how people do. And so, I mean, how to resolve that, I don't know how to resolve that. But I think there are a few important principles. If they were actually, you know, if they actually became widespread, I think some progress would be made. And I take Sri Ramakrishna's basic statement, as many faiths, so many paths, as being a very fundamental idea. Each person sees, I think, who was it who wrote, each shall see the reality, each shall, it's a poem, the reality as he sees it. No, each shall paint the reality as he sees it for the God of things as they are. I mean, as each person, we have to make this one basic assumption, that everyone is looking at that reality, whatever you want to call it, and having his or her own interpretation of it. We must respect that. And I think if we start with that idea, yes, this is their view of reality. I don't believe in that. I think they're totally wrong. But this is their view. And God dwells, or that supreme reality or consciousness, whatever you want to call it, dwells inside them also. Let it be. Let me have respect for everyone. I think that if that idea, just that much, just let us have respect for everyone. I know they're going to be saying something totally contradictory. Someone said, describing his religion a few days ago, someone said certain things that I could in no way accept. But I mean, it's all right. This is how he views that reality. That's fine. I mean, I wish him Godspeed. I cannot myself stomach what he's saying, but I will give him the right, you know, not only the right, I will recognize that he is looking at the same reality I'm looking at and seeing it differently. Well, fine, let it be. At least if this much of an idea comes across, there may be some progress made.
Hi, so I would like to ask you, so basically we're talking about the fact that to get closer to this infinite consciousness, like for humans there are ways, and meditation is one of them, appeasing the mind. And my question is, since everything is a divine, including things, not only I want to try to help humans reach that consciousness, which in a way there is an answer for it through meditation and teaching and so on, how can I help, let's say, a chair or a table reach that consciousness? And how can a table on itself kind of connect with that consciousness?
Well, that is... I mean, if you start analyzing and breaking it down, you see, as soon as you say anything about anything, you begin to limit it. The reality, that infinite reality, that consciousness that we're talking about, has to be a matter of experience. You have to experience it. When you experience it, when you describe what you've experienced, you're going to distort it already a little, as soon as you try to phrase it. Now, these things, the table is God and all that, yes, there is God alone. There's infinity alone present everywhere. I'm seeing it in this way. I'm giving it this garb of a table. But then you say, well, you go into detail, well, how can the table realize God? That is just stretching this thing too far. As soon as you start putting things into words, there's a point where very quickly you come to a point where you get into contradictions. I see this table. Now, what is the reality of the table that the table could realize God? There's no connection there. There's no real meaning in it. I mean, the consciousness is there. What you have to realize God. or let's put it this way, I have to realize God. The fact that you have to realize God is your own business. Everything that you see that's going to realize itself, this is, I'm looking at you. What this looks like from inside the table, I can't say anything about that. I have no access to that. This is something that I'm just viewing. So all I can say is that I have to realize God, and I can tell certain methods, and I can say, because you are similar to me and your reactions are similar to mine, I can also say certain things about you. But the table, I don't know anything about that in terms of reaction or consciousness or what. I mean, you can go to the vegetable kingdom, you can say some people are, of course, vegetarians, it's easy to say, I'm a vegetarian, I don't want to hurt animals, that's good. But then some people say, well, you're hurting vegetables, you're hurting carrots. Carrots are being pulled out of the ground. Yeah, carrots are being pulled out of the ground, that's true. But I can easily tell when an animal is hurt. I can tell when a human being is hurt. But as far as a carrot is concerned, I am really stretching things to say that this carrot is being hurt. Now you can say, okay, well, if I had a sensitive enough instrument, J.C. Bose was supposed to have this Cresco graph that could tell, even a piece of metal. He hit this piece of metal, and then later on, he had this instrument connected to the piece of metal. Later on, he would just lift this hammer, and the metal would go. Okay, but that's stretching things, I mean, you're getting way off to the edge. No, we won't go that far. No, carrots, all right. We can't say what a carrot would. So, but animals, yes, definitely. I can see there's pain there. I can see there's, suffering, so I'll take care of that. This table, I can't say anything about that. I don't know what this table feels. If there is such a thing as feeling for the table, it's a totally different universe. So I won't go there. I'll just go to those things that I know that I can make some sense of. There I will say, this you have to do to realize God.
For one last question, if there is one.
Well, it's wonderful you became a monk. Many of us have families and obligations that exist at this time. I wanted to ask about children and how you would present Vedanta, say, to a young child of about 8 or 9, let's say. As often we talk as if only adults are the ones who could be doing this work.
Yes, it's children, of course, are, in a way, children probably understand, if it's put into their language, they will understand it much better than adults. They don't have those inhibitions and all these decades-long predispositions that we have to counter. So they may accept it better or more easily. But it has to be put in their language. And if we can, Vedanta or any of our profound thoughts should be understandable by everybody. And if they are not, that means it's our fault for not having made them clear. But they can all be made clear. Vedanta can be made so simple. Swami Vivekananda's goal was to make Vedanta so, retain the essence and the seriousness and the purpose, but make it so simple that even a child could understand. So, it's our challenge to do that, but it certainly can be done. Now, as far as monasticism versus the household life, the realization of God has nothing to do with any of that. This is a matter of, choice or the matter of, maybe we're a matter of our circumstances. We may wish to be monks and nuns, but we can't be for some reason. That's, it's a different matter. But whether you're a monk or a nun or not has absolutely nothing to do with whether you realize God or not. The Some of the householder devotees are more holy than the monks. This is not, there's no requirement of that sort. The monk is has a certain advantage because society in its graciousness allows him or her to be protected. So it's like being surrounded by a protective fence. You know, so there's some advantage there, definitely. And then, but as far as the, some monks also deliberately lead very difficult lives just in order to be of maximum service. So it doesn't, it's really, the point is you have to be extremely serious about religion. Whether you're married or a householder, a householder or a monk or a nun, really is not the main question. It's a matter of personal predisposition and, the suitability of the time and the circumstances, all secondary things. The main thing, you have to be absolutely serious about your goal. That's the heart of it. Whatever your religion, you have to be absolutely serious about the goal. And that's the important thing.
It's 9:30, so it's that's about time that the Ahimsa sessions come to an end. I just received this flyer, if you want to pursue this. I think it applies to everybody in this room because there's the 8th Annual Youth Forum on Spiritual Values, ages 18 to 30. Nick, you're not qualified. And it's run by Swami. And it's Saturday, April 8th. Do you want to tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes, it's our 8th annual. Yes, in fact, I did bring my own flyers. Anybody who's interested. It's called, the topic is spiritual practice and spiritual fulfillment. The Berkeley Buddhist Monastery members, the Dharma Realm Buddhist Youth, have been very active in that youth forum. Lauren has been there. And it's the idea is we get together. Those who can stay overnight, we get together at Olima, our retreat, which is way out in the country, at Olima near Point Reyes Station. We get together the evening before, and there'll be some, we'll have supper together, and then there'll be some reading from all different religions. People should bring their own material. The next day, we have a session in the morning to discuss this topic in small groups. The people will divide in small groups, spiritual practice and spiritual fulfillment. What practices should we undertake and what kind of fulfillment can be expected? Then, for about an hour and a half, then comes a panel of, I want to call them elders, they may object to that, but senior representatives of different religions. And among these, Professor Ron Epstein will be there to represent Buddhism. And Hung Shur has come several times. Doug Powers came last year. So anyway, that representative of Buddhism, then Reverend Carol Hovis, the director of the Marin Interfaith Council, will represent Christianity. And then our Swami Prabuddhananda will represent Vedanta. And the Iftekhar High, a Muslim who is very active in interfaith affairs, will represent Islam. So there'll be a discussion there, questions and answers. And then after that, there'll be lunch for everybody, which we will provide. And then there'll be a two-hour work session. People get together, and actually people like that very much because the young people are able to associate with each other in a special way, And while they're working, we always have the men work separately with the monastery. The women work with the convent. Our convent members there will come on that Saturday. Then in the after that, we will take a walk to our temple site, which is a very wonderful place on top of our ridge. Have some talk and meditation there. Then we come down. We have another session of discussion of the day's topic. Then supper, and then afterwards, maybe after supper, some video, suitable video presentation. And the next day, Sunday, we just have the morning, and we'll have an interfaith service, and whatever different religions are present. Vedanta, we'll have some worship service according to Vedanta, according to Buddhism from the Dharma realm, Buddhist youth, and then Lauren and her sister last year did for Christianity. So it's a wonderful session. People just love it. So encourage young people to come. We're even willing to shade 30 into 31, 32.
Thank you. I'd like to take the devil's advocate position, which is natural to my being. And I just have a problem with the fact that religion seems to have, most religions are purely dogmatic. And they come from a belief system that is centuries old. They evolved from the fact that a few centuries ago, people believed the earth is here and the sun revolves around the earth. Disease and health and poverty and so forth were punishments for some particular attitude or lack of faith, etc. And that's created a huge amount of misery and suffering perpetrated by religious leaders in one way or another. From slavery to child labor to stoning and some of the other things I mentioned earlier. Science, on the other hand, examines things. What's really interesting, because you have a background in physics, which is kind of confusing to me, because you have a scientific perspective where you look at hypotheses, and if they don't work out, you discard them. But that same principle does not seem to apply to religion. There's as much intolerance and war, other than I'm really not speaking properly, because the people in this room and you have bypassed that intolerance to a certain degree. You wouldn't be here if there weren't this openness, this hunger for humanity and togetherness. But the vast majority of the world still lives on a much different plane. Anyhow, so my question to you earlier was how we can overcome this. And one of the objectives or goals of Ahimsa, because I personally think that through education, through discourse, through people getting to know and understand each other, which is part of what this particular event tonight is all about. We have had a number of events looking at people's belief systems, whether it's Hinduism. Our next event, which is April 25th, and you're certainly all invited to join us. It's by Rabbi Alan Liu, and it will be from a Jewish perspective. We've had Buddhists. We have, in the past, Joe Bobrow, who was a Zen Buddhist. Last session was Nahid Anja from Sufi. Anyhow, the object of Ahimsa is perhaps to try to understand and get to know one another through understanding, through food, perhaps, through education. Notice the pot belly. The food part of it works very well for me in terms of getting to resonate with one another. Anyhow, the objective of Ahimsa is looking at trying to get, Ahimsa is a Hindu word for nonviolence. So how do we get nonviolent? Getting to learn it and know each other from religion, from science, and perhaps from a social or humanitarian perspective. So that's what our goals are. That's what the activities that we have and the programs that we have. You're all invited to the next program, which is April 25th. It'll be Rabbi Alan Liu, and that's right here. There's a sign-up sheet in the back of the room. Those of you who are not already on our mailing list who would like to receive notification of our different events, please sign up. There's also a little gray box called a donation box, and if everybody puts in a few hundred dollars, that'll make it much easier for us to continue these particular events. Anyhow, I really appreciate your being here tonight. I've known you for a good long time, but I never had a chance to hear your inner depth perspective. So thank you so much for being here, and thank you all for coming. There is a